We have just not seen any gains since she started. And anytime I try to bring it up with Walter, he mentions the VB map and all the skills she's learning, but we can't help but feel that, like, I get it, Walter's trying his hardest, he's trying really hard. And when I try to bring this up to Walter, he mentions that she's great at taking prompted breaks and needing a few minutes to do her thing, and that she does great with DDT.
We don't know what DDT is. Like, that, what, when she's, like, sitting at the table, she's, like, sorting or pointing at stuff? Like, we don't really have concerns about her cognition. When we did the initial intake, we were really vocal that our real concern is her vocal scripting, and it's interfering with her day-to-day life. So she comes here 20 hours a week, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's for, like, the one thing. It's for her vocal stimming. Do we even have data to show that we've been making really any progress on her vocal stimming at all? Or are we just, like, giving her breaks and, you know, whenever she wants,
I'll tell you what, guys.
I'll be right back.
Hey, did you know you can actually earn BACBCUs if you're listening to this episode? If you'd like to learn more, including about our Behavior Analyst Certification Board CEUs, that is continuing education units for people that hold the credentials by the BACB, you can go to explanatoryfiction.com and find this episode. Welcome to Explanatory Fiction. It's very important that you know how this podcast is structured. We've randomly generated this case. The variables are entirely fictional. That's right, because with the power of math and science, you can actually do these things now. In fact, the name Marcy Dallas was randomly generated too. And the episode art, you guessed it, also made by artificial intelligence. But the best part is our team is real and the conversations that ensue are designed as a game that you get to play along with us. In each episode, we have one person that is evaluating the case from a clinical decision-making model, and the others are accomplices of mine who are trying to stump the analyst. Our challenge to you is, can you figure out a possible treatment model before us? Here we go. Marcy Dallas is a 5-year-old white female that lives with her parents in Portland, Oregon. She has been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and engages in some repetitive vocal stereotypy. Her parents are very involved and have been doing everything they can possible to try to understand autism spectrum disorder since their daughter was diagnosed. Marcy really enjoys time with her parents, carrying preferred items, and marble runs. On this episode, we're trying something just a little different. You're the clinical director of an ABA clinic where Walter is a BCBA that works under you, and while chatting over lunch about some of the different cases that Walter oversees, things take a little bit of a quick turn, let's say.
Hey, Dimitri, I brought you your bibimbap, extra yum yum sauce.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So I figured we'd just kind of get started. I know we're kind of short on time today, and so I'm just going to review my cases pretty quickly, and we can enjoy our bibimbap. So Lyndon has been engaging in some pretty high magnitude property destruction. It was a pretty crazy day yesterday. We had to clear out most of his room, but I think we've got it under control. The behavior support team was there. With Frank, he's made some really cool gains with his PEX board recently. We've moved on from just manding to tacting. Marcy's doing great as usual. She's doing her DTT receptive ID and sorting. No huge reports on her. Lisa had her first independent toileting trip, so that was really cool. We all did a big celebration afterwards with her their favorite candy, and it was a good time. You can have all that yum yum sauce, or can I have some?
Sharing is caring, buddy.
Excuse me, Dimitri. Oh, I'm so sorry. I know how much you don't like to be interrupted when you're elbow deep in yum yum sauce, but this is, really important. You know Marcy's parents? They're here to see you. Hi, Mr. and Mrs. Dallas. Here's Dr. McCready's, our clinical director.
Hey, Dimitri. We have a bit of a problem, man. When Marcy was diagnosed with autism, it really...
Well, okay, wait. I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt. But, like, Walter promised us that if we enrolled here, we'd see progress for Marcy. And that she'd be able to participate for the activities in church. And we're really expecting her to be able to participate in the seasonal play, and she was excited to participate in herself too. This year's play is based off the movie Elf, which you know is her favorite. When she started here, we have just not seen any gains since she started. And anytime I try to bring it up with Walter, he mentions the VB map and all the skills she's learning, but we can't help but feel that, like, I get it, Walter's trying his hardest, he's trying really hard, but he has, like, no idea about the goals and aspirations for Marcy. Like, first it's the elf play, but we need this to affect her future. This is affecting her day to day and her, like, just throughout the whole day, this is a problem. And when I try to bring this up to Walter, he mentions that she's great at taking prompted breaks and needing a few minutes to do her thing, and that she does great with DDT.
We don't know what DDT is. Like, that, what, when she's, like, sitting at the table, she's, like, sorting or pointing at stuff? Like, we don't really have concerns about her cognition. When we did the initial intake, we were really vocal that our real concern is her vocal scripting, and it's interfering with her day-to-day life. So she comes here 20 hours a week, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's for, like, the one thing. It's for her vocal stimming. So we don't really mind that when she does it, like, if the time is fine. But, you know, even Marcy's getting upset that she's missing out at the opportunities of church and these peer groups and to be in the play. Like, do we even have data to show that we've been making really any progress on her vocal stimming at all? Or are we just, like, giving her breaks and, you know, whenever she wants?
I'll tell you what, guys.
Hold on.
One second. I'll be right back.
That was heated, to say the least. Now, Walter is still in the room with Baxter and Sherry. All Dimitri did is step out for a moment to let things kind of simmer down. In the meantime, Walter is trying to do the best he can on explaining the situation as to why he made the various decisions that he has to date for their child. We're going to speed back up to when Dimitri re-enters.
So while you were gone, I was trying to
show
you.
Are you guys ready to have a conversation yet?
Okay, but I was trying to tell Walter
that, I'll be right back.
I've done research on...
Tensions are still high, so Dimitri exits one more time. Walter still remains, and he's again explaining why he made the various decisions that he has to date. Again, we're going to speed this up to when Dimitri steps back into the room.
All right, you guys ready to talk?
All right, Sherry.
Are we going to continue doing this?
Sherry, let's give it a minute, okay? Sherry, let's...
Okay.
Let's give it a sec.
Hey, Dimitri, I was trying to show them the graphs that I got here. So if you look here, I've got... And I showed this to them. I don't know why they're so upset, honestly.
Let's have a pause real quick. What are you talking about?
So they're mad about her stimming, and we've been working on her requesting breaks to vocally stim, and it's something that we're constantly working on. So I just kind of wanted, I was trying to show them the graph, where, I mean, here's where she was on day one. She didn't ask for a break to stim. And then, I mean, literally she learned it quick, and she's kept that mastery of asking for a break before
Walter,
she stims.
Walter.
Yeah. Yeah.
This isn't known. There are rules, Walter. Why are you asking her to ask for a break to stim?
So she can have time to do her thing.
I think Sherry and Baxter are absolutely correct to be outraged by this.
I mean,
it's a functional equivalence problem here, buddy. I think you and I need to work. Sherry, Baxter, I think we need to go to the drawing board and talk about this real quick. If you guys don't mind,
without me?
No, you stay here. If you guys don't mind, follow me to the break room. We have a little waiting area, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I just need to look at this with him real quick. And we'll come get you in a moment, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Marcy's one of our chillest kids. I don't understand why they're so pissed.
Bro, of course they're upset. You're not doing anything that's actually helping the problem that they want to start address, number one. Or number hold on.
But we've been going through that.
Also, we're talking about self-stimulatory behavior, right?
Yeah.
And that's what they want you to change?
Yeah.
So we have two options here. Either the self-stimulatory behavior is a problem that needs to be addressed because it's actually inhibiting her. Or number two, they want you to do something that just doesn't make sense, like trying to restrict who she actually is as a person. So we either have an education problem in terms of the parents, or we have an inhibited behavior that we don't have a functionally equivalent intervention for. So I'm just going to ask you a couple things here and just walk me through it. And let's go back to the drawing board so we can get these people like calm down and out of here.
Sure.
In a reasonable way. And we can actually address the problem that they have. Is that fine?
Let's do it.
Okay, buddy. What does the self-stimulatory behavior look like that they want to get rid of?
1 to 3 times per hour. She takes like 5 to 10 minutes where she's engaging in a vocal stim. Sometimes it's SpongeBob. Sometimes it's Ben 10.
3 to 5 times per hour, you said?
1 to 3 times per hour.
But for 10 minutes?
5 to 10 minutes, yeah.
Oh, man. So that's like...
She requests that as 20, a break, though. So.
That's like 20, 30 minutes an hour?
Yeah, it's not... every hour, but it's
on average it's like a third of the time.
I mean, I guess
that's a
lot,
you put
it that way.
Isn't that a lot?
I'm just
asking questions, buddy. I'm not mad at you here. This is fine. This is the learning process, but walk me through this. Like, that seems like a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to she likes her scripts.
I mean,
and I don't.
I like pizza, bro, but I can't eat it for every meal. I'll die early.
Well, but that's why we got the breaks.
Yeah, but I mean, the question that I have for you then is: are breaks functionally equivalent to the self-stimulation? Like, what purpose do the breaks serve in this reality, in this situation that you're trying to build here?
Because if she wants to script, she can say, "I want a break," and then walk away and script, and it's not interfering with stuff.
But the scripts are still interfering because there's no target to diminish the amount of time she's spending scripting, at least reasonably, to a point where it's not going to interfere with her ability to navigate the world. Wouldn't you say so?
I mean, I don't know. It's just, you've seen Marcy. Like, it's...
I have seen Marcy. That's what I'm saying to you. It seems to me like we need to target it down at least to a reasonable, like, timeline a little bit, to where, like, she can recover more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I just...
So that she can actually engage the world a little bit, because a third of her time spent in a verbal script. Dude, I mean, that means that, like, if she lives to be 60, she'll spend 20 years verbal scripting.
I mean, yeah, but...
That's a lot of lost time. Shows.
Yeah, I know. I know. I honestly don't know what to do. We've...
Okay, we can work on the intervention, but what we really need to do... Let's have a conversation with these people so they're not just verbally barraging me in the middle of my delightful bibby bop. Okay? Because between this amazing sweet teriyaki sauce and yum-yum sauce mixture, my lunch is ruined, and this is one of my favorite treats in the world.
I'm sorry that they busted in today. I know that.
Hey, these things happen, man. I'm not mad at you. I'm just disappointed. I'm just disappointed that you didn't tell me about this earlier. That's all.
I mean, I guess I didn't really realize what a big issue it was. I mean, I was literally, we talked about her in the... In the meeting we just had, I thought she was doing fine.
Hey, man, and it's okay. So you and I are going to work out some kind of tolerance program, some kind of like way to structure this so that she can have reasonable verbal scripting time when it's her time. But we're just going to teach it as like maybe a environmental discrimination training, where it's like you do you on your time, but on our time, you don't do that. And you participate in the process, right?
Yeah, I definitely am going to need some guidance on that. But yeah,
okay, that's
I
mean, fine. We'll sit down and talk about it in more detail, and we'll write it out. But that's kind of the general kind of framing that we'll take. Does that make sense, or are you okay with that? Is that logical to you? Do you understand why we want to do that?
And yeah, like, I just I don't know what to say in this meeting. So can you take the lead on it?
Yeah, no problem. Let's go meet with Sherry and Baxter.
Cool.
Hi, folks. How are you? Thanks for giving us an opportunity to sit down and talk. I just needed to get caught up on the situation and look at the data and the program. So I'm going to reiterate what your concern is real quick, and just make sure that this is actually what you're concerned about before I go into what I think we're going to do about it. So your concern is that she needs to participate in some activities, some extracurricular stuff that you guys ever signed up for. And the verbal scripting that she does just makes it to the point where it's just impossible for her to do that. Is that accurate and correct?
Well, it's a little bit bigger than that. So she's supposed to be participating in a church play. And, you know, we even saw some signs where some of her, like, best friends are starting to call her weird at church.
What? Who? Wait, who?
Oh, what was her name? Casey?
Casey called her weird?
Yeah, that's what she mentioned. Casey.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So
she didn't tell me that.
Yeah. It's a big deal. This is a big part of our lives, and she needs to be able to participate in this.
And too, I mean, she was cut from the play. So she can't participate in the church play anymore because of this. And this was something that's important to all of us. I mean, it's important to, like, the whole family.
Yeah, she burst into tears last night because we had to talk to her about how she's not going to be able to go to the practices, like, until... Yeah. What, next
year?
She
asked us if she could try again. I mean, what do we even say to her?
What do we say to her, Dr. McCready's?
Oh, is it my turn? I wasn't sure you guys want me to say something.
Well, we wanted to properly outline
the current circumstance. The problem
was. Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. I lost track for a second. So there's a couple things that we can do here. First of all, I'm really sorry that this happened. Obviously, we dropped the ball somewhere along the line here. This was not, we were not doing our job the way it was supposed to be done. So we just need to be very honest and transparent about that. We were targeting something a little bit different. We were trying to focus on communication And given the actual thing that you guys wanted to happen, what we were hoping to accomplish, it's not working. It didn't work out that way.
She's been doing great on the VB map, guys. I just...
Walter, this is not non. Yeah. There are rules, Walter. So, please, we'll get back to that. So what I would say is, unfortunately, we can't go back in time and change things. So I'm, you know, I just hope that you can give us an opportunity here to try to fix this and just have a little bit more clear-minded approach to this and maybe hopefully set her up in the future that we can repair this process. So what we're looking at now then is if the problem really is the amount of time that she's spending in the verbal scripting, then what we need to do is a couple different things. First, we need to figure out a way to shrink down the amount of time she's spending scripting. And secondly, another thing, a way that we could do that is by trying to teach her like her time versus, you know, the world's time, right? And Walter and I are going to sit down and really put pen to paper here and really sit at a whiteboard and really try to structure something clean like that so that I can really target this problem and directly. But just to give you guys an overall just kind of picture, that's what it needs to look like, I think, to address the problem directly. Now, I need to go back and address a couple of things that you said when you first came in terms of like some of the promises that were made to you. I don't know who made those promises to you, so but this is what I'm going to say. No one should have made promises about progress to you in any way, shape, or form other than we would do our best, we would monitor it, and we would give you a functionally reasonable equivalent intervention, and that we would make adjustments based on those data. Anything other than that is disingenuous and, quite frankly, completely unreasonable in terms of elevating your expectations. So if that happened, that was wrong, and I need to go back to the team and address that so that we're not setting everyone up to fail and also setting people up for potential disappointment. And number two is we just need to do some other stuff to just make sure that our communication, our lines of communication are cleaner. But given what I just said around that kind of intervention, is that something that you think is more in line with what you were hoping was going to happen?
No, I agree. We need to change what's happening so we're addressing the issue, but I'm a little bit peeved that we've been sending her here 20 hours a week, and I mean...
Here's what I'll say to that. What I'll say to that is, in this specific instance, you should... I get it. But she also doesn't come here just for that, and we have been making a lot of progress on a lot of the other skills we want to see coming along. So... we definitely dropped the ball in this one area, and this one area is so big, it's really disrupted your guys' plans and social lives. So I get why this just feels really raw and visceral for you. And again, I'm sorry about that. But overall, I have to say, her progress across the board is doing pretty well. She is acquiring a lot of language skills. She is acquiring a lot of life skills. She is demonstrating some social skills. We're just not really seeing that control shortening and like lesser periods of time that she's doing the scripting. So now I agree that's a big piece of this and we definitely need to look at it. But again, I wouldn't be so quick to lose sight of the progress relative to this thing. Again, I hear you. You're totally allowed to be upset about this. If it was my kid in the situation, I'd be totally salty too. Especially given the fact that, you know, you're going to go out, hang out, talk to your friends, reach out to your community, show off all the progress your kid's been making, and be stuck in a situation that you look like a fool. So I totally understand that.
Well, part of this too is that when she's supposed to be at play practice, I'm running my catechism group and Sherry is running her women's group. So now we're losing our ability to do the things that we're supposed to be doing because someone's going to have to be looking over Marcy.
It's very disruptive.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
You say this isn't potentially going to be as quick as we want, but what, how quick can it be?
Well, and I've been doing a lot of research on autism. I mean, and you know, they say like, just because you've met one child with autism doesn't mean that you know all of the kids. I don't know. It's some quote like that, but the research that I'm showing, I mean, I would expect more progress from her. And I feel like we should be more informed about what's going on because I'm trying to read everything I possibly can to really understand why and what treatment she's getting. You know, there are some parents who don't even like ABA therapy. And so it's like we're a little hesitant even sending her to begin with.
And here's what I'm going to tell you. I understand whatever hesitation you might have. I understand that there are some parents that like ABA therapy. I cannot control what people think or do. All I can do is control what happens in my four walls. And all I can do is take responsibility for what I have going on here. So that being said, I believe that we are taking responsibility for that. And I believe that we do control what goes on in these walls to the point where we do provide the best possible practice available. And other than that, that's a decision that you need to make for yourself. I can't convince you to think otherwise. So that's a decision that you have to make for yourself. This is a student choice or a program, and you're not just entitled, it's your right to make whatever decision that's best for you and your family. We completely understand either way. I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you otherwise. All I can say is that I do believe that we can get the job done. I do believe that we can do the work to the best of our ability, but I'm not going to guarantee a timeline or outcomes because, again, that would be setting all of us up potentially for disappointment. And I think given the fact that you've already had now this scenario that you had your hopes dashed, I would hate to set us up for another one like this. And I would not want to besmirch the name of the field and ruin our relationship by doing that. So if you folks would like to give us an opportunity for us to try this alternative, we'd love to give it a run and keep you apprised to it and let you see how the data is going from a week to week basis. But beyond that, unfortunately, there's not a lot I can do, but that's your decision to make. And I would never push you or presume for it to go any other way. It's your decision.
Sherry, I don't want to speak for you, but Dimitri, I appreciate the willingness to look at what we can do moving forward. I'm just curious if that's going to include Walter over Marcy's case still.
Yeah, I think we have some hesitations. I mean, Walter's a very nice person and a great human, but...
Thanks, guys.
But I would love to know, I mean, Dimitri, how involved will you be in his case, in her case?
And honestly, that's a thing that, especially now that we've had a little bit of a hiccup, you know, I think we'll just set it up so that I can be a little bit more involved. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we're a teaching and a learning institution for everyone involved as clinicians and practitioners get better as well. So I have been trying to promote a lot of independence and let that happen. And with that being said, I think that given this specific kind of problem and the technical complexity that goes with it, and the intricacies and nuance in terms of your guys' relationship to the thing and you know, everything, I'm just going to be more involved with it. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't think that Walter needs to be replaced or anything like that. I think he's more than capable of accomplishing this, especially together. And I think that it's a great learning opportunity for him to improve his skills as a clinician and be able to read these situations a little better. So, but, you know, again, if it boils down to you pull services or Walter's got to go, I'm going to say that I have to make the decision to stand with my clinician. And you're more than welcome to make an alternative choice. But, you know, Walter's assigned to the case. We've put our trust in Walter. And that's a decision that you have to make. Because right now, this isn't really like a personality clash. It's simply a simple adjustment in programming that needs to happen. That based on just a little bit of a misunderstanding in relation to expectations. Now, that's not to underscore the impact that it's had on your social life and your social expectations. But with that being said, it's not terminal in my mind.
I think we just need to feel confident in where it's going. And we need to have faith in the people that are playing. And that doesn't mean that Walter can't be a part of it. I want to feel confident that it is going to address why she's
here. And Dimitri.
Yes.
Do you have a work number or some way that we can contact you when?
Yeah. You can email me anytime. You can email me anytime or you can call here at work. And if I'm available, I'll answer. And if not, I try to get back to people within 24 hours.
Yeah. I mean, obviously stopping by isn't the best option, but we felt like it needed to be addressed.
Yeah.
I completely understand, folks. I mean, this was very disruptive to your lives and you're totally in your right to come and want to settle this problem. So it's no big deal. I get it. Again, in order for me to be more involved, I usually look at a little broader view in terms of supervision. So I'm gonna have to sit down and really look through the case specifically, really get into the nitty gritty of the way that her stereotypy and the way that it kind of manifests itself physically and that kind of a thing. to really pull it apart to get a good handle on it. But the overarching bird's eye view of it's going to be, we're going to set up some kind of limit in terms of where and when she can engage in verbal stereotypy versus where and when she needs to be engaged with other people and or instruction. And we're going to set up a reward system in some way to where over time we look to shrink that window. What I would ask from you is a little bit of patience in terms of us being able to get you very specifics on that. So give us a couple days for me to get in there and get my, you know, pull my sleeves up and look at this a little more closely so I can troubleshoot this a little bit better with Walter. I don't want to be pressed to just come up with something right here on the spot and be wrong, especially since we've already gotten it wrong once. So that way we can definitely ensure maximal likelihood of success. So does that overarching bird's eye view seem reasonable to you? Like more in line with what you were kind of hoping to hear?
I feel okay with it. I mean, is it still in the VB map or are we finally moving away from that?
And it's the VB map has nothing to do with this. that's where the mistake is. The VB map's about language building and all those other things. Breaks are about having work pulled away most of the time. In this situation, it's about the satisfaction that she gets from engaging in that verbal thing that she's doing. And so we need to target that kind of internal satisfaction that she gets in the whatever in the system that we're going to set up. But on the flip side of that, that means that we still work on whatever's going on the VB map. We still work on our language. We still work on all those things because things are relevant and important. So they'll just be happening alongside what this intervention is. And I think that's where Walter was coming from. You know, I think he was so hyper-focused on language and her growth in that point in time where it's like, oh, look how great she's talking. Look how her lexicon's growing, et cetera. That I think we just were underestimating and undervaluing the importance to you and the family. And honestly, for her ability to participate in her community, that particular behavioral problem. That's all.
Yeah, I think if we're working towards that goal of getting her involved and, you know, being able to have her be a member of our church, I think that's a worthy investment.
Okay, great. Well, then I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? Why don't we also just set up a phone call for next week? Okay.
Perfect.
And we'll walk through the plan explicitly so you guys have a very clear understanding of what we're going to be doing. And then that way you can also kind of give your thoughts on whether or not that makes sense to you. If you have any adjustments or anything you'd like to add to it. So that way
I'll do some research and I'll see what I can come up with.
I can't wait. Look forward to it.
That sounds good to me. Baxter, lovely. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, I'm okay with that, Sherry.
Okay.
And then after the VB map, we can move on to the AFLs.
Yes, Walter. Thank you for your time. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we'll talk about it, buddy.
You made it. This is the point in which you can pause. Think about what you maybe would have done differently. Think if there's any themes throughout this as well. We're going to break character here, and this just turns into a typical podcast where it's just an open discussion. I hope you enjoy.
First of all, I accept your attempt to punishing me. That's fine. I'm not mad at you. Actually, I was very just hilarious.
Disappointed.
And Walter, incredibly.
You left me with them.
Yeah, so that was the one mistake.
You know,
the one mistake.
How hard I try to show them my graphs.
I know that was so sweet. Like I should have. That was in real life. I would have leaned over and whispered into Walter's ear and been like, "Hey, buddy, go to the bathroom or go sit in somewhere else real quick. I'll be there in a second." And then I would have waited for you to walk out, counted to 30, and then walked out myself, and then froze them out for 5-10 minutes. Come back in. Froze them out again, 5-10 minutes, come back in, and I would have kept freezing them out for 5 or 10 minutes at a time until they stopped.
Would you keep coming back in with like new food the way you did?
No, that was literally because I haven't had dinner and you guys said I was eating yum yum. I was eating bibimbap, so I figured it was appropriate for the scenario.
Fair enough.
Have you used this strategy before?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And like, what is usually the parents' reaction? I mean, is it what Walter and
they get pissy. They get real super, they get super mad. It's an extinction. I mean, so they'll escalate a little bit, but like, we've been waiting here for so long. Like, absolutely. And when you're ready to have a conversation, I'd be happy to do that very neutrally. And then I walk back out.
And do you ever like, okay, so like kind of walk me through why you decided to do that. Cause I feel like it probably evokes a lot of like emotional reaction, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Right. I'm more just curious, like, do you like, Where did you learn that strategy? How did you decide it was the best one? And like, do you, yeah, how did you decide it was the best one?
I mean, it's a crisis management technique. I mean, that's, you wait it out, right? You, if someone's throwing a tantrum, what do?
They're in the red.
You stand them and let you verbally abuse you, let them verbally abuse you, or do you ice them out? Withhold attention, walk away, and wait for them to slow down and simmer till they're in a much more receptive state.
Well, and I also noticed that you used a couple like surprise responses that kind of put the parents as well as Walter in a spot where it was like, oh man, I didn't think he was going to say that to me.
Like what? What did I do? I don't even know what I did.
Oh man, I'm drawing a blank on it at the moment, but there was one. Oh, they were kind of ranting and you're like, oh, it wasn't my turn. I kind of lost track for a second.
Oh, I do that kind of stuff all the time. Yeah, you have to, like, here's the thing in helping. This is the part where I might talk a lot. So this is where you guys can interrupt me if you need to. But it's kind of an involved thing because it's like social dynamics. And like, it's hard to describe social dynamics without kind of going into a little bit of a thing. When people are spiraling, okay, and in general, they're upset, especially parents in this kind of a situation, power dynamics play a role. In most situations, especially like if I'm a clinic director of an ABA clinic versus say, and they're the kind of people who are bringing their kid to a private setting to get therapies, right? They're used to being able to go to a school that's a public setting where they have a thing called FAPE, which is free and appropriate public education, and they can verbally accost and abuse those people, and they just have to take it because legally and federally they're required to, and they have no option. However, in like in any negotiation, the one benefit of being a private institution is I can say no. And in any negotiation, whoever's willing to walk away is the winner. And in those kind of situations, I'm willing to walk away. Like, I won't ever permit anyone to verbally accost my staff, even if they're right, or just steamroll me in a way where it's impossible for us to effectively communicate. Because how do you actually build a functional therapeutic relationship that way? So you say some random, I'm sorry, one more thing. Because I want to say the actual, I want to address the actual thing with the like, why do you say a random statement thing? Sorry, just one thing.
Yeah, let's do it.
With the random thing, it's like, number one, it's a conversational tester to evaluate whether or not their mood is stabilizing or whether or not they're still completely in a heightened state. And number two, it's a way to show and assert yourself that you're not their doormat. So if they're going to continue, you have not been affected by their nonsense.
You stood up for Walter pretty quickly. And I mean, Walter kind of sucked.
Walter was atrocious. But, you know, that's part of like, if we're talking about being a clinic director, we're talking about leadership, right? Fish rot from the head down. So if Walter sucks, that means I suck. And if Walter's sucking, then I need to fix what I'm doing with Walter because he's my responsibility. And in that situation, those people are talking to me. So if you're going to obfuscate or throw someone under the bus, all that does is undermine your credibility as a leader. So, I mean, I'm of the school of thought, like the Simon Sinek school of thought, leaders eat last, and you don't throw your people under the bus. You eat the poo in front of the people. And if you got a problem, you pull them behind a closed door and you have it out then. So Walter would have known behind closed doors how frustrated and disappointed and frankly, probably angry at the time I would have been at his behavior. And we would have definitely had to have some kind of conversation about how you do that in the future. And I would have definitely tightened his leash in a way where I would have known everything he was doing for quite some time. But never, ever air your dirty laundry in front of the public like that.
What happens when it's not your clinic and it is a FAPE situation where so much of this has become, yes, we are providing a health service, but there's also a huge customer service component of this, right? So how do you approach that in a play nice sort of way?
I mean, my day job is in a FAPE situation and I still do this kind of stuff, so I don't care. But that's me. I mean, I'm willing to assert myself in that way. But honestly, that's where, you know, I've been able to gain enough reputation and enough confidence from my colleagues to where they use me for that, like, because they're not confident enough to be able to do that. Because when it boils down to it, look, we were wrong in terms of like the kind of intervention we were doing for that. But their reaction was totally uncalled for and out of line. Sure. And they were mad because of how it affected them. They weren't mad because their kid wasn't making progress.
I mean,
so like, so it was petty.
I mean, I feel like a lot of these roundtables, I go back to like what the script was originally intending to go for. And one thing we were really trying to push is like the fact that Marcy is, and we didn't get to talk about it, but there's not really a cognitive concern with Marcy. It's literally they sought out services for her stimming, and the BCBA completely ignored what the entire point of them seeking out services was.
Yeah. And I think this is one of those situations where this scenario pushed me to where we were, in that I wouldn't have necessarily asked all those exploratory questions in this situation to be able to work those details out, because presumably you should already have a lot of that stuff, just general knowledge as part of being around that person in the shared space, even if you don't know all the intricacies of the case itself, because some of those things should just become apparent in some kind of interaction. So, knowing that information now, oh my God, I'm more mad at Walter, but, you know, I really don't know how much more I would have been like, yeah, that probably doesn't make sense. That would have been the only change in my answer. Would have been like, okay, well then she doesn't need the VBMAP if she's conversational. Like, what are we doing here, bro? You're just doing this because this is what you do. Cause it was at the point of you guys including the VBMAP was like, for me to be like, why are we using the VBMAP for a kid that can talk and has words? Can conversationally
more so kind of just to play on the defaulting on an assessment being the only tool that you utilize as part of a treatment plan.
Oh man, that would have been a wonderful discussion piece.
Well, let's discuss.
I mean, what do you think? You, first of all, you know what I'm going to say about this. So, you know, the audience might not, but you do. So, I mean, like, what's your reaction to those situations?
I mean,
like, how do you handle it?
How do I handle it as a clinical director or as a
just in general, like, treatment plan? Or just how about just generally the idea that it seems that BCBAs have this penchant for default technology.
I think it's problematic. I think that it takes away the individualized approach to therapy. I think it can be helpful as a tool to guide things in certain directions, but I think that the field has this tendency to move through each step of each assessment without really asking the why behind it.
Is that necessarily unique to BCBAs though, is my thing.
What I was gonna say. I don't know if there's data that supports this, but like I see this sort of like relying on some sort of structural thing of I do X, Y, and Z to be able to solve problems, and it's not an actual critical thinking task, right? This isn't marketing. Oh, let's write a listicle of the top five things. Let's just do a billion of those. You know, like that'll get stuff out of here.
is this an issue of supervision and potentially being
training programs?
Part of that, but also like you can do your entire experience in one location with one person, and you could use
two locations with one person.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. And you could, we were BCBAs by then. But I don't think we were actually. You could get really good at one thing and that's your only comfort space, but that doesn't mean that the clientele that's going to come your way down the line is going to match that one thing. You can try to make it fit, but
wild that we're like in part of the medical field, but like haven't adopted any of the medical practices of like doing rotations and going to different places to get different experience, right?
Yeah.
And sure. I don't know if that's the ideal thing to copy. I feel like Dimitri's lip is raising right there as I say that. but like we could have some sort of structure that we could put in place, at least test out and see what happens there, right?
Well, I'll make 6+ figures after to justify the 6 months we spent living, making nothing in a random city somewhere, certainly.
Right.
I mean, standards of care matter. Standards of care are called standards for a reason, because they should be ubiquitous. This is a supervision problem. It's an educational problem, but it's a cultural problem too.
I think it's also an insurance problem.
It's a funding problem. Very good.
I think, at least I know writing treatment plans, there's this pressure, if you work with insurance, to hit not necessarily a certain number, but kind of a certain number of programming goals that you've got. And you might have a family that comes in and says, hey, we really just need to work on this one thing. And insurance says, well, I know that you need X amount of time to work on this one thing, but can't you be working on other stuff too? And sometimes it's not always that you need to be working on other stuff.
Can I just ask you what makes you say that? Like, how do you, like, because I don't know of a situation where an insurance company is going to be like, no, add more stuff.
Well, oh, does that will, actually happen? I mean, not to me personally, but it is a, I mean, companies that I've worked for have said, hey, let's aim for X number of goals for X number of hours. And this idea that they come in and just say, hey, we got this one thing that we're working on and it doesn't pop up on the regular. So we kind of have to have a dedicated amount of time where we're able to observe and look to target it and end up having to kind of, I mean, put in some filler goals to justify the time.
Is that funding agencies or is that the ownership of the organization?
Yeah, I was going to say that's an organizational thing. That is not, has nothing to do with insurance companies. Insurance companies more focus on utilization of hours. There's about utilization percentages for the most part. That is the metric that they care about. So if they approve 20 hours, that's the dose that you've quote unquote prescribed. And if you're not giving them 20 hours, then the reason it's not working because you're not maximizing your dose. So the question really is, if the problem should only need 4 hours a week and you're an ABA company and you understand the financial viability of providing services to a person with a dedicated one-on-one requires usually, if you look at the financial models, about 20 to 22 hours a week worth of billable time out of an RBT and about 20 to 25 hours out of a BCBA for minimal profitability, then you can't take those kind of cases realistically. So in order to fit those kinds of cases into your model, so that to maintain a certain level of financial viability, you do that. The real question then becomes, is there an issue with the financial model of these ABA companies? But that's a totally different bag of tricks that...
I don't know. I mean, I definitely think that, I mean, there's a component of companies wanting to push a certain number of hours, but I have a hard time believing that I could say, hey, this behavior happens infrequently, so I need set amount of time to be able to target it and work on it, even when I'm contriving scenarios. And I've just got this one goal and I need some amount more than 2 or 3 hours a week to work on it, but it's just this one goal. I haven't encountered it, but I don't see it flying with a insurance company looking.
No, it won't fly with an insurance company because they'll say that it doesn't necessarily meet the threshold of medical necessity. Okay, that's the whole point. The whole point is that, like, the way that we've structured the financial models, the service delivery models, all that stuff, it's tailored around the prototype person from a medical model's point of view who receives services is 2 to 7, 2 to 12, maybe if you're really pushing it, you know, mild to moderate autism, maybe severe autism, you know, but minus the high intensity behavior portion of it, right? More like severe in terms of intellectual capabilities or capacity, and it's paired ID. So like when you start deviating from that general archetype into what was the child's name again?
In this Marcy.
Scenario, Marcy. Into the Marcy scenario where, and again, I didn't know this at the time, but apparently no cognitive delay, super mild autism, and really just focusing on this one little aspect. That's a problem, which also begs a question then, why can't you write, and this is where we're talking about filler goals, then at that point, are you, if you're providing an educational replacement service under the guise of a medical model, and they're not filler goals, you're actually providing her suitable things, you're just phrasing them in medical terminology to ensure her ability to participate in the program. In that case, I don't see an issue with it. But that's a matter of framing, not, you know, that's not a company exploiting somebody. That's just a company providing the kind of service that they provide in the way that they have to deliver the service, and the patient, student, child needs it, you know?
Well, I think back to like the EBD population where there's no cognitive delay at all and the behavior is high magnitude but infrequent, and insurance companies straight up won't approve academicals. So if it's outside of that VB map, or it's outside of ABLES or AFLES, what do you do to get the time that you need to work on this behavior while still...
I'm so glad that you asked, Max. That's such a wonderful question. You use some of our explanatory fiction tools in order to... No, I'm just kidding. But I mean, like, what you do is you learn how to articulate academic goals in a behavioral fashion. So if we're talking about reading, right? I mean, reading is what? It's expressive labeling, right? It's just expressive labeling to a certain rate. So if you just... It's really about learning how to translate the lingo into...
What if the kid doesn't need to know how to read?
Well, I mean, that's just an example.
Here's the thing is you have X number of hours per week. Like, Walter could have graphed how the work was going as well, because some work is taking place if there's breaks to go and be able to stim, right? Like, you're still... In this case, we're assuming you're still providing some level of education if they're attending the school. So, like, the academics can still... be socially significant in that time if there are context for working on real meaningful goals.
I think we're engaging in circularity here. It's a circular argument, and we're engaged in a category mistake. We're presuming that there is because we've been told that there's a difference between educational and behavioral goals, therapeutic goals. Okay. That's a false assumption. So, I mean, like, what I would argue is, you need to tackle that assumption. There should be no to say these are the academic goals versus either the behavioral goals should be like a literal preposterous statement to say out loud. It's nonsense.
As a gen ed teacher, I would say that I agree.
Yeah, right. I mean, you tell me in your classroom, especially given your background, actually this is interesting because I wanted to bring this up before when we were talking about when I asked the questions about is that just BCBAs who are tied to their default technologies? No one is more tied to default technologies than teachers. Teachers use the word curriculum like a weapon in a way like it literally makes my head split because I'm like, I don't even think you know what you're saying anymore.
Y'all got to do more of that direct instruction.
So if you were put in a situation where you had to do exactly what you do the way that you do it, but rather than use your gen ed education speak, you just had to flip the language into your, you know, ABA medical insurance speak, can you do it? And I think the answer should be yes, but that's a training problem. That's not a problem with the methodology. That's not a problem necessarily with the service delivery model per se.
Yeah.
That's a problem with the way people understand how to articulate what they're doing. So that becomes a conceptualization problem. How do you think about behavior and how do you think about the work that you do?
I have to agree with the conceptualization problem, because right now the prevalence of behaviors of concern in the classroom and a lack of ready learner behaviors is leading to the need of those voices coming in, because a lot of districts and schools know how to tackle the academic pieces, but even contextualizing, sitting and attending to things as the behaviors we need to be explicitly teaching and front loading in the beginning is, I mean, that's a massive focus right now, because that's a massive need. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of these kids just spent a whole year where they got maybe 20 minutes straight of instruction on a computer sitting in their pajamas on a couch and never being asked a question.
Mm-hmm. So now we're looking at all those soft skills and, you know, behaviorists love gambling. And I'll tell you, a lot of online Chromebook programs give you a lot of little good gambling and games and inherent reinforcement systems that me reading Frindle or Boxcar Children can't latch onto. They'd rather watch certain videos. So now what has typically worked with like group activities or group reading, there just isn't the attention span or the tolerance or whatever that specific skill is to enjoy or synthesize or really participate within that for a lot of students.
So what this really is then is an instructional problem. Like that's again, like it's a multifaceted problem, right? It's how do you articulate the thing? But what you just said, Dave, to me, that sounds like an instructional problem, because the idea that you're setting up your instruction as a teacher and you don't already have in your mind a contingency for how you're going to manage student responding. Okay. Whether it is in small group, large group, or, you know, one-on-one, that
That well, means you're not doing your job right.
And a lot of it, I mean, this kind of goes back to like the teacher training programs. I mean, a lot of it is topographical, not at all functional. So it's, if a student's blurting out, I do this. And it's like, okay, well, what is the function of them blurting out? Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to go into like, why is that happening? Not just this blanket, this is how I respond. Because that is teacher training programs. It is, they do X, I do Y. Every single time. There's no data to inform that. There is no functional analysis, nothing.
So back to the whole thing in terms of ABA programs being tied to a VBMAP or like that kind of default technology thing in relation to that. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is that do you learn how to execute on a functional approach or do you focus on topographical box checking? Because that's what the education system is. The education system is topographical box checking. That is a beautiful way to articulate it because that's exactly what it is. It's frustrating as all hell because, you know, great teachers, quote unquote, all they're doing is accidentally bringing in a little bit more of that holistic functional approach without even realizing what they're doing. But that's what it is if you know what you're looking at.
Yeah. And so it could be so much more intentional with better
exactly.
training.
So BCBAs or like behavior analysts, if we're thinking of the ABA clinic as the time-wise too, as an educational equivalent, right? So like that's us acting in a teacher instructional capacity, almost equivalent to the amount of time that we're spending in a school setting. If we're not doing the functional approach that is the purpose and design of a behavior analytic program, then I would question, and some would probably argue this is a true Scotsman's fallacy, but I mean, I would question, are you engaged in a behavior analytic practice? You know, I don't think so. You know, I think that you're engaged in a good high feelings practice and a feel good situation, and you're selling some kind of product with, you know, shiny balloons and puzzle pieces and, you know, excitement and rah, rah, rah. But you're not really producing results or targeting things for effective outcomes. Man, this took a dark turn. Man, was that the goal here? Were you trying to get this like all like morose, bro? Like what?
No, you got mad as we were, or not mad. You said we were talking in circles as I was trying to plug one of the few predetermined actual points for growth that I was trying to throw a word in there, and then we were engaging in circle reasoning. I do think that discussion went into a good place because it's going to ring true for people that are entering those kinds of systems right now. I mean, Abby and I are both navigating some of those kinds of systems right now. So
do you mean in public schools?
Yeah. And I mean, you are too. You're working with those individuals, which is why when we're talking about you can do a mic drop and walk away from these situations. Like
you can't, Dave, hold on. Cause well, I know what you do. Why can't you?
What's that?
What are you afraid of? What I would say to a person like you, and this is where like, you know, don't get upset with me, please. Okay. But like, I have to challenge you on this.
Sure.
What's stopping you? Like, why can't you do the right, like, you know what the right thing to do in that situation is, right? What are you afraid of? You're going to lose your paycheck?
Dimitri, I don't think that
119,000 jobs for BCBAs and only 60,000.
Oh man, you can work to talk over me, Dimitri. No, this is, dude. I can walk out of a meeting if I want to because my stakes are low. But I'm an empath and I work with a lot of people that can't walk out of those situations. And you know, I prefer to prescribe medicine that I'm willing to take. So I need things that are going to stick. I need things that are applicable, that people can use when they're encountering these challenging customer service situations where someone comes in and they want to speak to the manager. And this is an auditory medium, but I'm shaking my hand on camera. But like,
what? So like, because I kind of agree. I mean, I am a perpetual people pleaser. I have a very hard time like setting those boundaries and like, you know, we're working on it.
Same.
But yeah. So like, what would you say is maybe like a baby step, like the next step that somebody who feels uncomfortable, you know what I mean? Like just setting a hard, I'm not going to talk over you. I'm not even going to talk to you right now until you're calmed down. Like what would a baby step kind of look like?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The baby step is, I mean, honestly, the first step in any problem is admitting that there is one, guys. I mean, I know that sounds so cliche.
Is it also the last step?
No, but I'm not. Oh my God. I love you so much.
Homer Simpson.
I love you so much. It's the first, but I mean, like for real, like if you really recognize that about yourself, then you need to decide whether or not you're okay with being a doormat or not. Like, I can't answer that question for you. Like, you have to make that decision. And the other thing too is, are you really okay with the result that it's breeding? Because like my thing is mission. Like, I focus on mission. That's the way that I find the audacity to behave sometimes the way that I do. Is that for me, it's like, my mission is to maximize the outcome here, and I want the best possible result. And I want everybody to be okay with each other in a way where it's like, I don't appreciate disrespect. I'm going to treat you like, I believe in the reciprocity principle. So I give as I get. I mirror my conversational partner. So, I mean, but I've also sat down and I've made the active decision that I am not okay with that. And that's a hard red line for me as a human being, living the limited amount of years I have on the planet. And that's that. So I would turn that to you and say, if you're okay with that, then there's nothing wrong with it. But then you also have to be okay with the results that you get. We can't also have a conversation where we're complaining about it.
I sometimes wonder if like experience in other domains starts to shape how people get more comfortable in making these sort of decisions. Like, you might not do it clinically, but like if you have certain business experience, like when you're talking about the first person that, or the person that is willing to walk away is one that's going to win in that conversation.
That's a car lot lesson for sure.
Yeah, but like, like when I've slowly had to learn like pitching my value and the stuff that I do under my business. And then there are times where it's like, I crunch the numbers. Someone wants to do it for something under it. And even if I say no, and I need to find something else, it's like, that was a lesson that I learned on, I drew a line somewhere and over time it's worked out. And I kind of carry those things in other areas. I don't know if it's healthy or not too. Right. but does, you know what I mean? Do you see where I'm trying to go here, Dimitri?
I think it gets a little easier every time.
Here's the thing. It's one of those things where I think, especially in these professional situations, you have to go through that fear threshold a couple of times to be desensitized to it. Because, I mean, we're conditioned to be worker bees in our society. Our education system is structured to create compliance. Whether or not you think so or not, I mean, like, our entire system is designed to create people who say, yes, okay, no problem. And they get in their car at 8:00 a.m. and they leave their work at 5:00 and they go home. They live their lives of quiet desperation. Right. And that it ends. And like, that's okay. But I mean, at some point in time, you make a decision, especially if you're going to, because look, for me, I see our work as this is a mission. Like, I made an active, I could have been a lawyer. I could have been other things. I chose this life of poverty and self-abuse and flagellation because I want to help people. Whether or not I do it in my way that seems idiosyncratic and, you know, eccentric at times, or even terse, doesn't matter. In my heart of hearts, I want to see a better world. So, and I want to see people do better. And I believe especially that kids with disabilities, people with disabilities, families that have children with disabilities who suffer, like, they deserve smart people doing those jobs, not the C students that they get. So if that's the case, then you got to actually bring that A student energy. And A students don't take shit. Just how it is, man. And like, they tell the truth, even if it hurts them. And that's that. And sometimes the truth hurts. People need to hear the truth, because in education in particular, there's so much mollification and implication with these, like, these kind of parenting scenarios where it's like, at some point in time, once I would have built rapport with these people, I would have probably had a conversation with them. Like, listen, we got to talk about your kid here a little bit, because I think your expectations might be a little bit off. I see a really bright, wonderful little person who, yeah, she's got some quirks. She's got this stuff going on. She's this way. We can work on shaping around the edges. But at some point, when is this about you and not about her? And have you reflected on that? I mean, we're called helping professionals for a reason. Like, we need to help people come to certain conclusions that they're not willing to see. So anyway, I'm not trying to monopolize, but like, that, like, that's a thing that I think you have to decide if you're going to live a life of value or not, like, consistent with your values or not. If those are your values, you live it.
So I kind of wanted to go back to, because I think that there were points in how you handled the parents that surprised us all. And I think that it's not enough to just look at that one behavior that you did of the walking out. You have to look at the entire context, because by the time, like, you got what you needed from the parent, and then you spent that time like work for both your employees and for the parents. And I think it's a lot of times viewed as this like all or nothing. So it's either I am a doormat or I am like assertive and I am like taking no shit and like, you know what I mean? Like handling it very aggressively. And it's not that.
That's a really
it's
good
like
point.
Here, you know what I mean? Like here yeah, is my boundary point. And then giving some.
Yeah. So that I think what you're pointing out is a mistake that most people, if they make the decision where they want to be more assertive in this work, that's the
yes.
And I made that mistake early on too. And I did make that mistake for a lot of years where you become a fucking hammer and a bull in a china shop, right? So you have to find the median there. But then that also just becomes being able to recognize where people are in the stages of emotionality.
I wanted to talk about that because I feel like I've had a lot of very escalated parents. I mean, I've talked about with you guys how like we have 60 students, which is combining classes. A lot of those parents are unhappy with what's happening. And a lot of that was taken out on me because they were very confused what was happening and I was not in charge of that communication. And it was definitely a lot of like, I think that goes back to the function of like, why are you mad? What's going on? Like, how can we have a conversation? And sometimes that looks like walking out. Sometimes that looks like setting the heart. Like, I can't talk to you when you're talking to me like this.
I mean, I think it helps to look at it the same. I mean, looking at the crisis curve the same way you would with a more traditional maladaptive behavior is, I mean, if you're up here, you're just seeing red. There's no.
Most people don't know what the crisis curve is, Max. You might want to explain it.
All right. So the crisis curve is this idea that as behavior escalates to a peak, it's a bell shape, where when you're at like the 75% of the way up the ramp there, you can do some basic responding, but not any sort of like learning or productive conversation. Once you're at the peak, all that is out the window. As you kind of start to come back down and you're at that 75 mark again, you can respond to some stuff, but nothing really of substance. I mean, if you look at road rage, that's going to be your peak. There's just no getting
through.
Road
rage.
Yeah. And I mean, you literally become, you're not able to speak. You become a different person more or less. And you really got to come back down to that 25% before you can really start to have any sort of meaningful dialogue. So de-escalation is the key in those moments.
The challenging part of that is some people can come in and be so aversive, it's so much easier to just get rid of them by appeasing them to rid yourself of that continued aversive stimulus. I keep calling it the Karen contingency out in the world, not to offend any Karens that are out there. I apologize. It's not a name thing. It's just everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say it. But it's just like when people come in and they're so pumped up, it's just easier to get to appease. And that does set a trend to where you're setting the expectation for how individuals can get the things that they want by coming in heated, by coming in amped up.
You reinforce it. And I've caught myself doing it with staff where they come in hot and it's like, oh God, I got to fix this. Even if like, I mean, a lot of times sometimes it does require fixing, but the immediate response to fix it while they're that heated, it ends up ultimately being unproductive because every time they've got any sort of, feedback or thoughts regarding an issue, they come in at that level again because they know that's what gets an immediate response.
Mm-hmm.
And it wears you down, man.
Dude, if you're engaged in escape and avoidance behavior, though, that's a problem, dude.
Oh, no.
And that's what that goes back to being self-aware. And that's why leadership, like we're talking about, like how do you distinguish leadership skills? Like if you're trying to define leadership skills, what you just defined was a leadership skill, is that like leaders don't avoid. Okay? They don't engage in escape and avoidance of conflict because their job is to steer a ship in a particular direction.
But
so
I think
if you're in a leadership position, you need, whether or not it's aversive to you, and if you've accepted that responsibility, you need to, if you don't have those skills, you have a responsibility to develop them.
Yeah, but I think you can mediate and navigate as a leader without responding to high magnitude.
Without negotiating with terrorists.
Yeah, man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And that's, dude, that's exactly. But how many times have we said that behind closed? Like, dude, I don't negotiate with terrorists, bro. It's America. Like, no, you won't hold me hostage. You won't come and browbeat me. Like, no, that's not how this works. That's when we're talking about hard lines and that kind of thing. Like, when do you interject those kinds of things? If someone is engaging, and this is actually a game theoretical thing, this becomes a prisoner's dilemma. If someone drops a zero, if someone's playing a zero sum game and they give you a hard line where it's a take it or leave it, then you have a choice to cooperate or defect. That's the zero or one that you've faced with. Any attempt to compromise from there, whether or not you think so or not, you've chosen to cooperate, even if it's begrudgingly. So then you need to deal with the consequences of cooperating within a prisoner's dilemma. And just so you understand, the effects, the math of a cooperating in a prisoner's dilemma, you go to jail for life. So like, it's a literal mathematical reality that you lose if you cooperate in those scenarios. So you have, if you want to even just play this quantitatively correctly, you need to be willing to defect in those scenarios. And that means walking away.
Yeah. I mean, just letting it simmer a bit before.
Picking up the pieces.
Yeah.
I think that also tells you a lot about the person you're dealing with too. I mean, if they're willing to then move forward from there and say, okay, you know what, let me take a step back or not, that kind of tells you.
That's the sign of forward. The sign of good faith that can or cannot happen.
Dimitri, did you have game theory in your behavior analytic training program?
I did. Technically, yeah.
PhD?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I did my dissertation on, right? The social game theory, yeah. But I mean, like,
if it's your dissertation, I don't think it counts as your programming. I think that was like, you're such a nerd that you're like, I gotta know about this, and I gotta dedicate dedicate a couple of years of my life to this.
It's about decision making. Yeah, I mean, listen, well, I mean, behavioral decision making. But yeah, I guess it's not normal reading, right? Because most people who study that study in economics or political science, in terms of like the idea of game theory, is this. Game theory is taking, rather than taking individual behavioral choices, you take a behavioral choice relative to another person making that choice. So basically, you're quantifying a social decision, and two agents are making independent decisions of each other with mutually responsive consequences. So if you choose A and I choose B, these are the consequences. If you choose B and I choose A, these are the consequences. If we both choose A, these are the consequences. If we both choose B, these are the consequences. And then all game theory is, and A and B are basically the reinforcer value assigned to those particular choices. So then all you're doing in game theory is you're manipulating reinforcer values to see how people make decisions relative to those values, relative to how other people choose over time to understand the consequences of those decisions. So like, a prisoner's dilemma is the most famous, most common scenario in the kinds of reinforcer values that are assigned to particular outcomes of choices. And actually, all of our politics and economics are based on the idea of a prisoner's dilemma. It's this idea of zero sum and like pure anarcho-capitalism, quote unquote, right? The second most common one, and that would be Rousseau. So like, if you study Enlightenment philosophers, Rousseau was basically, you know, a big writer of the French Revolution, and a lot of the French Revolution was based on his writings. Was called a thing called the stag hunt. And the stag hunt, the game is structured in such a way where the reinforcers indicate maximal value or maximal gains if you cooperate. So it's really about the choices that you have in any social situation. You have a choice to cooperate or you have a choice to defect. So you have a selfish choice or a pro-social choice. And you just literally set up values and you see how people choose pro-socially or antisocially. And you can, you know, predict how they're going to make certain kinds of decisions, or at least predict what the optimal kind of decisions in those situations.
Cool. Thank you. I just think a little overview is nice because it impacts damn near everything.
I mean, game theory is used in politics. It's used in economics. It's used in psychology. It's used in the studying of decision-making. It's used in, I mean, it permeates social enterprise. Every time there's two people involved in anything, it's a game theoretic question. Poker, actually, like there's a thing in the poker today where like old school poker versus new school poker, since the advent of computers and stuff,
New school poker has become a lot of stats and stuff. It's literally ongoing optimal game theory decision making. They even call it GTO. Are you making game theoretic optimal decisions?
I remember so listening to a Lex Friedman podcast around that.
Yeah, that's GTO is a thing. That's game theoretic optimal decisions. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else we need to hit on?
I think we hit on our main points. Nice job being nice to Walter. That didn't surprise me, but
get out of here.
That means a lot.
A little bit of a browbeating.
It a little bit hurts my feelings that you guys try to play it up that I'm so mean to you. It's a little bit extra. I was not a monster to you. You wouldn't be here if I was. Tisk tisk.
But there was, even in the last roundtable, we talked about a little bit of a browbeating.
That was because I thought you had grown enough as a professional to tell me to shut my mouth. I was just waiting for you to assert yourself, and it didn't happen.
Oh, no. I mean, when we were last roundtable referencing the past, we acknowledged that there was some browbeating. So let's not pretend there wasn't.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Again, you were a punk, so you weren't as bad as Walter, but you made quite a few bonehead Walter-esque moves that really put us in put me in a lot of bad situations. I had to clean up after you.
If you're earning BACB CUs, your code word for this week is supervision. Again, if you're earning BACB CUs, your code word is supervision. Just head over to our website, explanatoryfiction.com, and the process is super quick. Again, that code word is supervision. The views expressed during the Explanatory Fiction podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of any position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice. Remember again that the variables in this case were randomly generated, as well as the name and the episode imagery. Thank you, math. Thank you, science. And thank you, artificial intelligence. Rhino LLC is an approved continuing education provider that is ACE number #OP-19-3037, and the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, also known as the BACB, a registered trademark, does not sponsor or approve or endorse Rhino LLC, the materials, information, or sessions identified herein. Thank you for listening.